Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's about time we do interviews here this week. And joining us, I feel like I don't even need to go into a long introduction, although I could. He's MC, professor, journalist. Did I leave anything off the list, Bun B?
Father and grandfather, that's about it.
Yeah, man, that's on there, man. So we appreciate you joining us. We were kind of hoping that when we had you on, the Rockets would still be in the playoffs, but unfortunately that's not going on anymore.
Oh, my goodness. Don't remind me, brother.
Dude, I'm just wondering, though, because I looked up one day, man, and you had become like the OG ambassador for Houston sports. Like, that is your role now. It seems like it doesn't really matter if you haven't shown up.
Right, and it comes with its highs and its lows, obviously. You know, it's a good thing when the Astros are winning the World Series and things like that, but it's not so good when we have to go up against the Warriors in the Western Conference.
Yeah, like I feel like rooting for Houston sports, and I was around them. I wasn't like the biggest Houston sports fan at the time, but I was around them. We got that Rockets championship, and I don't know if any city is powered by having those two championships quite like the Rockets are, because it's been a whole lot of heartbreak on all the other stuff, but we got those two.
Yeah, we'll take that. You know what I'm saying? As far as sports legacy go, we'll take that. You know what I'm saying? We'll take those two. No asterisk used here in Houston, by the way, just so we get that clear. Hakeem was the greatest in those 2 years, regardless.
Yes.
So we take those two. But now, you know, we're pretty big with these Astros now. I'll be honest. We're pretty big with these Astros right now. It took a while. I was there when they were losing 100 games a year, but it's really turned around. And, you know, you have a young team of cats that actually like to play together. And that's what the city loves about it. Win or lose, these dudes actually get along. Like, it's not fabricated. They didn't bring in a bunch of dudes who are just money players and whatnot. They actually built this team from the ground up. And the core of this team actually really like each other as people, which I think is unique.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is, like, win or lose, but, like, we kind of need you to win because the Astros went from having those zero TV ratings, and then you give a glimmer. It's like, oh, no, we there. Well, okay, cool. Now we win it. All right, we can make this work.
Yeah, now just give us some hope. You know, it's not like football. This is Texas. We go into a football game regardless. That's not even a question. So Reliant will always be packed. But with these other two, it gets a little iffy every now and then, you know.
Yeah, so how's it going with the Rockets now? Because, I mean, I feel like these last two, they had those chances. And then, I mean, it's not like they got beat by scrubs, but it still doesn't feel good to get beat.
I feel like last year they had a better chance last year than they did this year. They were up 3-2. On the Warriors. They only had to win one more game when Paul went out with the hamstring. This year, I felt like they just weren't mentally prepared for this team. You know, physically, they're ready to play, you know, but Clint just, I don't know, he couldn't get with it, man. Like, these guys they're old pros to this, you know, this is just another game to them. This ain't nothing. This ain't even, you know, this ain't the final. So the playoffs for them is really nothing. It's very casual basketball for them. You know, but I will say that kid Looney gave us some grief.
Now, let me ask this. Did the city react to this with disappointment or anger?
Disappointment. Because they know they got a good team. They know they got a good team. But at the end of the day, they can't. This is really only a bit about the Rockets. It's really more about the Warriors. And we know that we don't match up well, you know.
No, I'm with you there. So how you feeling about the Texans this year?
That I don't know, because the Texans really, they live or die by the defense. You know, they're going to score points. Sean's going to get active. He's going to score points. You know, DeAndre's going to catch the ball and get touchdowns. But it's all about our defense right now. You know, it's always been about the safeties and the corners about this team. You know, that's the only thing that we always kind of felt funny about. And the right side of the O-line, too. That thing's been leaking, like I said, for a couple of years. But it's Texas. It's football. We're going to go to a football game. We love the Texans. All they got to do is beat Dallas whenever they play Dallas, and they're golden here. That's all they got to do.
Yeah, the thing I love about it is because I grew up when the Oilers were there, and when we decided to let the Oilers go. Like, I've never seen a city where the football team was like, hey, man, we're going to go to Jacksonville or wherever they were. We're going to go to Nashville. All right, cool. We'll holla at you. And then got a new one, and then it's like the enthusiasm around that one was so much different than it was with the Oilers. Like, the peak Oilers, we was all about it. But then it just got to a point where people were like, nah, you can leave. It's cool. We straight.
Well, yeah. We don't take being threatened lightly down here, as I'm sure you know. And this is football country. We'll get another team. Like, that's not even the question. This is all money here. There's tons of billionaires here. Somebody's going to buy us a new football team. That's not even a question. You know what I'm saying? So if y'all just feel like y'all got to go, go. You ain't got to do it in the middle of the night like Cleveland. You just go.
We'll help you pack.
Straight up.
Hey, let me ask you this. Since you've been around and doing all the stuff with the sports, like, who's the coolest person that you've gotten to meet through these affiliations with the sports teams?
Wow, that's a good question. Probably George Foreman.
Really?
Yeah. First of all, he looks great for his age. You know what I'm saying? But, man, them hands are like pineapples. Like, he's not big like Shaq. Like, me and Shaq is, you know, obviously everything is big because Shaq is overtly big person. But George isn't, like, a huge dude. But his hands, man, they're like Spalding balls coming off his arms, man. But couldn't be more down-to-earth, couldn't be more personable. And probably Akeem, you know. Akeem is everywhere. And he's very sociable. You know what I'm saying? He's not funny acting. He's very approachable. And he's very cool. Now, the fun guy from all of that is probably, you know, Bagwell.
Oh, really?
I got to sit next to Bagwell during one of the playoff games last year, man. And that is a fun dude. I imagine that guy has been the life of the party for a while.
I was thinking about you talking about George and those hands. It is a very unique human experience when you meet somebody with hands that just catch you, right? Like you dab George Foreman up, and I imagine it's like, oh, okay, I see why you did that for a living.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was obvious, you know what I'm saying, that you were going to beat people up at some point in your life. You just figured out how to contain it and control it and get paid for it. So I commend you on that alone.
Now, you can tell a lot about a man by his hands, right? Like, the first second you meet somebody, you give somebody a handshake and it feels like it tells you the whole story. And with George Foreman, it tells you, dog, it can go down right now.
Yeah, you know, you're either going to feel baby lotion or sandpaper. And you got to know who you're dealing with from that.
Yeah, man. I want to switch gears with you a little bit. I want to tell the people about this with just a little, like, you know, me and you cool to a way. I don't try to pretend like oversell my friendship with you, but we can get on the phone and talk every now and then. You were in the news a couple weeks ago with the incident at your house, and I was real concerned, and I wanted to send a text and be like, yo, I hope everything is okay, and I was being real kind of gentle about it because it seemed like a sensitive situation. Man, I looked on Instagram, and it was you resending everybody like, y'all know better than to run up on Bun's house. I was like, oh, okay, so you guys made peace with that.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't conflicted in the situation at all. You know what I'm saying? You cross the line, and that's what we do. It was a random attack, so it wasn't like it was something that was kind of planned for me. It just kind of happened. I'm always more concerned about my wife because, you know, my whole thing is me being prepared to confront the threat, to deal with the threat. But unfortunately, because of the way it happened, she had to confront the threat initially until I could get to the threat. So that's something that really bothered me about it. But other than that, you know, in the moment, we did everything we were supposed to do. I'm glad I didn't kill the young brother, even though in the moment I probably was trying to. But to be fair, I would not have felt good killing a young black man, regardless of the circumstances. But at the same time, I got to protect my family. That's a no-brainer. Like, I'm a husband. That's the only job I have, is to protect her. You know, the way I provide for her will vary. The way I love her, depending on the relationships and all of that, may vary. But the initial job of the husband is to protect the wife, period.
I just wanted to know where that dude thought he was.
He was going door to door, like in the little community. So he was just kind of, you know, looking under doormats and ringing doorbells and trying doorknobs to see if he could kind of make his way in the neighborhood. So he had started from the front and kind of worked his way to the back. When he rang the doorbell, my wife was thinking it was an Amazon package, which my wife never answers the door, and she didn't check the camera, so she did two things that day that she normally wouldn't do, you know what I'm saying? But that's human nature, like I said, you know. She was expecting something, and, you know, it just kind of happened that
way. Yeah, I just operate on the premise in Texas that somebody got it. Like, that was my thought. Like, when this happened, I was just kind of like, this is a desperate person.
Yeah, I don't know what this kid was really thinking in terms of that, just really going to somebody's house like that, you know. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend anybody else do this for a living, you know what I'm saying? This kid was very lucky that he only got shot in the shoulder, because I am a really good shot. And so the reason he got hit in the shoulder is because he ducked to the side while he was in the car. So the shot that was going for his head hit him in the shoulder. But, you know, everybody's safe and everybody's good. So we'll take it from there.
I understand that, man. So for you, man, how was life in general? Like if you were look back 20 years ago and they told you that the life you have right now is the life you had, is that what you would have bet on or expected?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. Not even close, to be perfectly honest. Like, the circles that I'm allowed to move in now, the people that I mix with on a daily basis, the things I've done, the places I've gone, not even close. You know, if you'd have told me that I would be driving across Europe high speed with 120 millionaires and billionaires, I wouldn't have believed it. If you'd have told me I would have been nominated for 2 Grammys, I wouldn't have believed it. If you'd have told me I'd have had an album debut number one in the country, like not the rap charts or the underground, like on the Billboard 200, like I wouldn't have believed it. If you'd have told me that I would have had dinner at a table right next to Obama and met Obama, I wouldn't have believed it. You told me I had the family I have right now and how excited I am about, you know, being a grandfather and all this stuff. I absolutely wouldn't have believed it, you know? And I still feel like we got a little bit more to do. That's the crazy part. Like, as far as we've gone, I still feel like we're not really where we're going to end up at, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, did you have a moment where you realized, like, oh, man, the game is flipped up here?
Yes. Probably doing Summer Jam with Jay-Z. And we were the last song of the night. And like, we're on the stage and there's 60,000 people from New York in front of me. And like, confetti falls from the sky and the whole stadium started dancing. And everybody's waiting on me and Pimp. And I'm just like, this has to be it, you know? Like, this has to be it. And then 4 years later, I'm on stage with Beyonce in front of 80,000 people. So, like, I said, every time I think I was there, was even close. Hell, I did Glastonbury with Dizzy Rascal. That was like 175,000 people.
That's wild.
Like, something crazy like that. Like, where got on stage and literally could not see the end of people.
Yeah, I guess that is a ways from doing the clubs with UGK coming through in, like, 1992.
Yeah, no, this ain't the Rhinestone Wrangler, for sure.
But it's wild, though, also, because doing, like, it's not as though, like, doing the Rhinestone Wrangler was separate from this. Like, you guys had a real clear, we hold down our base, and then from there got connected with everybody else. You know, so we all know the story with Big Pimpin', where there's the apprehension about whether or not to do it. But I think the most interesting thing to me about your career in UGK is that this is not about, like, a compromise or anything like that. It was people coming to what it was that you were doing.
Yeah, and that was the key thing, right? Pimp was always, you know, his motto was, why be number two or number three in somebody else's system when you could be number one doing your own thing? And so for us, it was always about maintaining the integrity of not just UGK, the group and the music, but what it actually stood for, what it meant to people, right? This was the underdog. This was the guy that didn't compromise, didn't take a short, didn't sell out, you know, all of those things came into play when you considered who we were and what we had achieved. And so we always wanted to maintain that for them, to let them know that the little guy in this game can still win. Because no matter where we had gotten to, we were still the little guy. Even when we got into big stadiums or whatever, we were never the headliner. We were always the closing act. I mean, the opening act for that stuff. So we were always trying to get further and further and go higher and higher. And it was because of who we represented and who we were doing it for, right? There was an idea that these two guys from this very small town represented the underdogs in every town.
And I don't think a lot of people realize, like, y'all have been doing this, have been doing it literally since the 80s. Like, there's a lot of stuff on the Southern Way is recorded in, like, 88, 89, like, coming around in that one. So, like, this is a 30-year career that you strung out with this.
Yeah, yeah, because the first song that we started doing would have been in 88, 89. Like, probably the earliest version of Tell Me Something Good comes from, like, 89, 90, you know. So, yeah, in terms of that, we are, you know, in terms of what we were doing now, as far as actually, like, putting stuff in the marketplace, you know, that comes around in 92. But as far as, like, actually making the music, creating music, performing music, that started in high school. And that was something Pimp was doing before I even got with him, you know. So Pimp had been doing, and Pimp was younger than me and had started music before me. So him and DJ DMD and video director Boomtown, all those guys were the first people to actually start making music in Port Arthur. We were just the first guys to actually have music pressed up and put in stores.
Like, so what was the scene in Port Arthur at that time? Because as much as hip hop swept the nation, it didn't hit like every person there. So I wonder, being in a town like that, I know you talk about like trying to explain this to your mom and your parents and not getting what it was that you were doing. So what was it like rapping in Port Arthur then?
It was just, you were in different people's bedrooms, basically. You know, there was no recording studio in the city. So it was really about who could order the best equipment from Radio Shack, right? So, you know, certain guys had synthesizers, certain guys had drum machines. You know, one guy had a 2-track recorder, one guy had a 4-track recorder. Two brothers had a lot of equipment. It was just really about, you know, how liquid your family happened to be at that time. You know what I'm saying? What kind of job did your mama and daddy have at that time? And then the other side of that, as far as like really just it getting into the culture and understanding the culture, was DJs. You know what I'm saying? We had a couple of DJs in town who were members of what they call record pools. A record pool was basically a DJ would pay this company, this record pool, X amount of dollars, and every month they would get records. They get 12-inch singles from all over the country. And, you know, the record pool would recommend certain records over others, and that's how certain things got buzzes. And I'm sure payola was in there somewhere, but I don't want to put that jacket on nobody. But that's kind of the way that the music would get to us, and then we would just have to try to figure out how to rap to stuff. A lot of it was really, you know, rapping over other people's instrumentals, but then guys like Pimp, guys like Weston Avery Harris, guys like DJ DMD actually started trying to produce music, and then other guys around the city started trying to figure out how to rap over it.
Like, I was imagining the learning process on that too, because it's a lot of teaching yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the funny thing about Pimp was able to use like the Insonic keyboard and ASR-16 without actually reading the manual, right? Like, just kind of cutting on the machine and starting to just push buttons and seeing kind of what happened. Now, based on the different equipment you had been around, different equipment you may have had, or what you may have seen, you would understand certain things. I remember us recording in New York, and I'm in the booth playing vocals, and this kid comes in, he got a bunch of braids, you know, going down his head, some cornrows. And he's in there, you know, Pimp don't see him, and he's in the room, and I'm trying to tell Pimp, you know, somebody's behind you. And then so I come out the booth, and I go in, I realize it's D'Angelo. And so D'Angelo's a fan. They told him we were there, so he came in and introduced himself. And Pimp's there at the keyboard. He's at the ASR-10, and he's like, oh, that's what you use right there? He's like, Pimp's like, yeah, that's my voice. He's like, oh, yeah, I did my whole album on that, right? So then kind of after we talked and he left, Pimp was like, yo, I don't know about this machine. If that man was doing all of that on this machine, I need to really rethink. I might need to read the book. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, D'Angelo's first album was amazing. You know what I'm saying? Musically. And it was just beautifully put together. And like you said, I was like, yo, I played everything on that thing. And people were like, I'm not even getting a tenth of what I need to be getting out of this machine right now. That's what he doing with it.
One thing that's always interesting, I feel like, when I hear you tell the stories about Pimp, is that as much bravado and stuff as he gave off to us, that self-awareness always seemed to be so high when it comes to stuff like that. We're like, oh, okay, well, I did not know this was possible. Okay.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of clarity when I speak about Pimp C, right? Just really these moments where he's like, you know, these, like Oprah would call it, aha moment. Mm-hmm. It was always interesting watching him have those, you know what I'm saying? Being in a room with different people. And you know, this is a guy who was like, I need to recreate this Midas guitar sound, but I don't know nobody that can play that good. So I need to call a Midas, and literally reaches out and gets in touch with Leo Nocitelli and convinces him to come and play his music over again on our album. Like, ridiculous. You know what I'm saying?
I did
and
not
it's
know
still
that.
Some of the most beautiful. Yeah. So it's still some of the most beautiful. Yeah. That's literally Leo Nocitelli playing the guitar on Ryan Dirty. On Ride and Dirty, on I think some songs on Super Tight, but maybe not. But I know for sure Ride and Dirty and Dirty Money, like a lot of our guitar, all the guitar work on Ride and Dirty is Leo Nocitelli for the Meters. Like, we literally had a B3 and a Leslie in our living room with a guy playing that, with a bass player and Leo Nocitelli, and they're just having jam sessions. And then Pimp would go back and go through the music and take the best parts, and that's the soundscape for Ride and Dirty.
So there's no phone call he's scared to make, is what it sounds like.
No, not at all. You're just going to have to tell him no. And he can handle the no. That's not a problem. But you're going to have to tell him no. And, this is where really the funny thing about it was the technology had finally gotten to where people wanted it to go, and he kept pushing back. He's like the Jack White of hip-hop, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to do everything digital. You know, like Ryan Dirty is probably the first hip hop album recorded in Pro Tools. A lot of people don't know that. But at the same time, he didn't want it to sound like a digital album, because the more digital it is and the more you get away from actually having 2-inch tape, there's a sonic difference. So he wanted to make sure that our albums would still go to press off of 2-inch tape. Even if we were mixing songs in Pro Tools, we still need to dump it to 2-inch tape and then go to press from there. And Riding Dirty, you play it next to any other album, is going to be louder, fuller musically. I dare you to put it on. Put an album on, play it at 6, then take that album out. And, well, I'm thinking people got CD players and shit. But that's how old I am in the moment. But literally, you can play that album next to other albums, next to other songs, and you'll realize sonically it's different. It's clearer, it's stronger, it's louder, and the music is warmer. And that's a conscious effort by Pimp as a producer.
Well, the warmth is the thing that always got me. Like, a UGK record always feels different. Like, one of my buddies, Petey Green, he does the intro beat for this show. The thing he always talks about when he talks about Pimp is like, man, his music theory game was so strong, right? Like, he's like on that technical level, you get that. And then with that analog sound, it just feels better. It's like the difference between playing on a record player versus playing on an MP3.
Absolutely. And he's right about Pimp as far as music theory is concerned, because he was an extremely well, I don't even know how to say it, like Riding Dirty. Riding Dirty is a title track. That's a Wes Montgomery song, right? Jazz record, right? And that's a record that we had been sitting on for years trying to figure out how to incorporate that. And Pimp would literally, I tell you a story. So Quit Hating the South, right?
Right.
Quit Hating the South comes out on the double album after Pimp is released from jail. Now, Quit Hating the South is a song that Pimp had been producing since Riding Dirty. So every album, Pimp would go in, he would produce it, he would listen to it, and he would erase it and be like, nope, it ain't time yet. Dirty Money, nope, it ain't time yet. Goes to prison, comes back, and sees now the proliferance of not just Southern rappers, but Houston rappers in general, having this big influence on the South, but not necessarily getting the proper credit for it. And so in his mind, yeah, now it's time. So then he makes it, and he's like, there's only one other person that understands this, that understands it the way I understand this, how long they've been hating. So he goes and gets Willie D and puts Willie D on the record. And it sums up everything that we had always felt and always seen, but now the rest of the world can see it too, right? So now it doesn't just look like we're hating or we're salty. Now it's a real thing.
That might be my favorite Willie D verse, because I don't think Willie D meant anything he ever said more seriously than he meant the words on that one.
Oh man, he was so serious about it, right? Like this was the call he had been waiting for, right? You know what I'm saying? Because this is what he had been saying since the 80s, right? This is what he had been talking about for years. And now, you know, and we understood it because we saw people hating on them. And we got in the game and we could see the industry sort of kind of hating on us and, you know, really kind of treating us like redhead stepchild of sorts. And then to actually see Southern people actually selling millions of records, it's like, okay, nobody's a bigger rap group than Outkast. You know what I'm saying? But nobody really says that. But you know, and we're talking about like musical chart dominance, huge records. You know what I'm saying? You know, constantly changing up their style, doing, you know, the evolution of Outkast is amazing.
Yeah, and see, it's like, it's interesting when I hear you say that about you guys, because I always felt like, I always heard people talk about how underrated UGK was, but I was in Texas, so there wasn't no underrated. Y'all were everything. But I never really saw the people that were actually hating. Like, how did you feel it, or like the moment that you noticed for yourself in the game that like, oh, they're just going to treat us different because of where we're from?
Well, I feel like, you know, like Riding Dirty, for example, got 3.5 stars in the source. And I knew Riding Dirty was a better album than that. Like, if you want to say that about Too Hard to Swallow or Super Tight or whatever, that's fine. But Riding Dirty was a perfect album, right? I watched that album come together. Now, it's not perfect by any effort of me. I put minimal effort into it in terms of what the way that Pimp thought this album out, thought the creation of it, put it together, everything. Anybody that was involved with that would tell you that album, the creation of Riding Dirty, is different from any other album I've ever seen created, because it literally was the first time we had full creative control of a project, and Pimp was allowed to do everything exactly the way he wanted to do it. And execution on it was flawless. Like, everything hit the right note. All the songs hit exactly the right way. And the key to Pimp's genius was order. Because you can make all these good records and put them up in the wrong way and people not be able to catch a vibe, right?
Right.
So for him, the most crucial part of an album was the sequencing of the album, which songs went where.
It also helps on that album that you killed it on every track.
Well, all I had to do was rap, Bomani. That's all I had to do. I didn't have to mix shit. I didn't have to do none of that other shit, that none of the technical shit. All I had to do was rap, and he gave me everything I could ever want to rap to. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's where Murder comes in. You know, the whole intention of Murder is to give me a song that shows that my lyrical capabilities are up to par with everybody else in the game at that point. Like, period. That's the whole purpose of Murder.
And that happened. That, because that's the, like, the intro, then it's One Day, and then it goes into Murder. And that's one where I just remember the first time I heard that, where we just sat there like, I can't believe this is one man doing this. What's that, like 64 bars?
No, I think it's only, I think it's 32.
Oh, wow.
I think it's 32. I think Pimp's a 24, and I think I'm a 32.
Like, you knew at the time, like, this is going to blow it out.
Kind of. I knew I had written probably my best rhyme to date, but I was, so we're recording in Pro Tools, and I have the ability to punch in, right? But I refuse to punch in because this rhyme, I have to be able to say this rhyme anywhere at any time with no studio tricks, right? And so we're the first people with the ability to punch in and a song that kind of calls to be punched in. And I said, no, I'm not punching this in. I'm doing this with natural breath control because I want to be able to execute this on stage as well. So we did it once. I was like, let me do it again. I did it again. And that's what you hear on the album is the second take. And I literally was hungover. I was fucked up. I went out the night before. So I was asleep the whole time. I wrote the shit. And then they woke me up. I went in. I did it. And I went back to sleep. I met Biz Markie. And I had never seen him before in person. I was, you know, I grew up on Biz Markie. I was a huge, huge fan of Biz Markie. And I introduced myself very humbly, as I always do with the OGs. And he was like, Bun B, oh, Murder Rap. And I was in. I was like, okay, I know it now. New York, no, Mina, it's on.
And it was like, it was a step up. Like, the first two albums were really good. But you in particular, that was a step up on the third one. And I think I read something where you were talking about somehow Outkast kind of inspired that step up. Do I have that right?
Well, I mean, there was always this thing with UGK, Outkast, and A-Ball and MGG, where we were always kind of trying to one-up each other without it being like, it wasn't a friction thing, or, but people would always, like, everywhere UGK would go, people would ask us about A-Ball and MJG. And we didn't meet A-Ball and MJG till like 95, 96, right? But everybody assumed that like us and 3-6 Mafia and Outkast and everybody was all hanging out together, and we weren't. Now, we eventually did, but we would always look at Paul and Juicy and the way that they would create music, right? Create these soundscapes and be like, man, we got to have a cohesive thing like that. And they were looking like Ball and G and their symmetry with each other lyrically, you know, how they never stepped on each other's toes, right? They were always very clearly different people with different approaches. And we were like, we got to make sure that we have these very formed, very well-formed identity, very clear, no ambiguity about who we are, right? And what we represent. And then with Outkast, just to not being scared to try other things musically, right? And incorporating the singing. Like, Pimp C had huge amount of respect for, like, Sleepy Brown as a singer and as a composer of music and arranger of vocals. And he was like, man, you know, like, we can do that too. We just can't be scared to do that. Like, we're not trying to be no singers, but we're going to sing about some real shit. You know what I'm saying? And that's what he would do. And he kind of turned that notion on his head about how that was received. Rappers didn't really sing back then. Rappers would go get a singer, right? You'd have a T.J. Swan, Nate Dogg, and guys like that, you know, but for the rapper to actually be doing some of the singing was different at the time, you know? And Pimp was at the forefront of that, which no one really talks about now.
But when you get, like, when Riding Dirty came out, because I think, I remember, I'll never forget, I heard you on the radio in Houston talking about it, because this was after Reasonable Doubt, and it was written to come out. And if somebody's asking, like, yo, so what's Riding Dirty? He's like, hey, man, you riding around, got something funny in your cigarette? Hey, man, that's Riding Dirty, dog. And I was all over the Reasonable Doubt when it came out. And I was like, I'll come check this out. And then I was just like, oh, wait a minute. Okay, this is a whole nother level, because most of the stuff I listened to at that time was coming out of the East, because I was putting a real, you know, I was a little bit underground backpack sort of dude at that point. This was one that just kind of opened my eyes. Like, I think it was for me maybe like the first time I fully got what UGK was doing and like fully got what Pimp was on at that time. And I wonder when you guys did it, if you felt like, yeah, this is the one that's telling people exactly who we are.
Yeah, because we had been denied that, right, on the previous two albums through sample denials and, you know, different stuff that they didn't want to clear or didn't want to pay for. So we were kind of forced to make other music to fill in those blanks. But this was the first one where they just let us do whatever we wanted to do musically. It's like, just bring us the album. Because we had spent so much time arguing with them between albums. That's why UGK albums only came out every 2 or 3 years. So we spent a year and a half arguing with the record company. And this was the one where we were like, you know what? We're not even tripping on money. Send us equipment, right? Just send us the equipment and we'll send you the album. Don't worry about studio time. We turned the house into the studio. You know what I'm saying? Like, we soundproofed the room, and we, like I said, we had the B3 Hammond and the Leslie in the living room and had all of this stuff and did all of this stuff in the house, right, and brought them the album. So that the idea of Riding Dirty is basically a night in the city of Houston on the south side, right, during the beginning of the Screw era, right, like that time where there's still the tension between the south side and the north side, where the north side dudes were jacking dudes and stuff like that. And so being in the city around that, there's this whole little world, right, this microcosm inside the city of Houston happening on the south side with the Screw Tapes and Kiki and all these guys and the candy painted slabs and all of that. And we knew this was something that would be, you know, if you could put people in that world, in that place, you know, in that lifestyle, that they would get a kick out of it. And so, you know, we on there talked about Sip and Drink and candy paint and swangers and all this shit, popping trunk and all of that, and neon. You know, everybody down here, like, obviously they got it, right? Because this is a Screw Tape kind of brought to life, almost, you know? And the record company just did not understand it, you know? They just didn't get it. And so that's why there's really no videos for Riding Dirty, because the kind of videos they wanted to shoot, we refused to shoot. But the album still went gold with no video. There was never a music video for Riding Dirty. We didn't even do the commercial. We were sitting at home watching Rap City, and we went to the commercial. And the commercial for our album came on.
And so it's crazy because that's the one that took off with people. Like, when you find out that Jay-Z is like, yo, I've been jamming this thing for the longest. And at that time, it was not, I think for younger people, don't get, it wasn't that easy for things to get out of your geographic area necessarily in 1996.
No, and that's something that obviously is taken, you know, fully for granted. I mean, this is back in the days where rappers couldn't even play house moves, you know? So it's a totally different time on every level in music. But the idea of someone in New York listening to a Southern rap album, it's physically, you know, capable. It's obviously there, you know what I'm saying? But we don't even stock that much in New York. Like, you would get the list of how many tapes and were even being sold in certain areas. And I'm like, well, why do we only sell 150 CDs in New York? Oh, well, because we only stock 300 in New York. Well, obviously, so you're not even making an overt effort for New York people to even, you know, be aware that this shit is out. So it was crazy on all sides.
Like, had you done shows in New York and stuff up to that point?
No, UGK had never performed in New York. UGK's first performance in New York was at Summer Jam.
That's wild to think, man. And that, you know, I guess that was still
like closing Summer Jam.
Right.
And that's when I said, that's when I knew was changing. That's when I knew it's really finna be on now. Like, we've been rapping, but we're now actually fully in the game now, right? There's no way to deny who we are at this point.
And that's what, summer 2000, right?
Yes, sir. And keep in mind, this is a 1-2 punch at this time, because we've got the biggest pop record in the world with Big Pimpin', but we also have the biggest street record with Sippin' on Scissor. This is the same summer.
I had forgotten.
Like, we literally filmed Big Pimpin'. I went home for like 3-4 days. Pimp stayed in Miami, and Fitz filmed on Scissor about 5 days after Big Pimp.
And that was, like, for me, that was why after me and my partner was going to the record store every Tuesday, because they kept telling us Dirty Money was coming out next week until like the end of the year 2000. We straight up went from March of 99 to the end of 2000. Like, Dirty Money get in yet? Nah, they say they're gonna let us know.
Yeah, because we weren't a priority at that time. You know what I'm saying? We were never, probably until Pimp came home was the first time they ever really looked at us as being a priority on the label and being, you know, putting everything they had behind it. And, you know, we understood that, you know, there were things that we did that we could have handled better. A lot of crazy shit. did, a lot of crazy shit they did, but everybody's older, everybody's more mature now, and everybody gets it, because they see now Chad's gone to jail, and then the time that he's been gone, every single thing we talked about with Riding Dirty is now the soundtrack to hip-hop, you know, because you got the Paul Wall from Thug and Chameleon Air and Mike Jones and all this shit is happening everywhere, and they're like, oh my God, this is what Chad and Bun tried to tell us about 5 years ago, you know?
And that's the summer 05. And that, like, for Houston, that was such an interesting summer to watch with Houston rap. Because Houston rap, you know, I always felt like if it got out of Houston, cool. But cats were able to get rich just staying within Houston. And that was the summer everybody broke out. And I always felt like, though, everybody was like, we out here right now. But if we stay where we are, we still going to be cool.
Yeah, I mean, they enjoyed it. You know what I'm saying? Everybody wants to be appreciated. You know what I'm saying? And good to be appreciated and get paid, too, at the same time. So, you know, a lot of these young cats were really just happy to get more shows and, you know, and stack a little bit more bread. But it wasn't like a make or break thing. But, you know, you're not going to turn your nose up to it either. You know, it just really just felt like hard work paid off for a lot of people. Because, you know, these dudes worked hard. These dudes grinded it out the hard way. And they played the game like it's supposed to be played, you know, kind of like baseball. They played it clean and it paid off.
Now, for you and this really the music of the South, rap music of the South in general, did International Players Anthem feel like a coronation as you were doing it? Because I always describe it as like the South won. This is maybe the best producers ever out of the South, the two best rap groups out of the South, and just put out a classic that everybody knew was a classic the second they heard it.
The only way that song could have been better is if somehow we could have got Ball and G on it. Because the whole idea of that song even coming together is crazy, because that song is not even supposed to be that song, right? The original version of that song is UGK and 3-6 Mafia, right? And this is when 3-6 Mafia wins the Oscar. They go back to their record company to renegotiate. They tour with the record company, and record company stops clearing them vocally. But their production deal is separate. So they can still produce records, but they can't feature on records. So now we have to take them off. Also at this time, All-Star Weekend is happening in L.A. Separately, Big Boy and Andre both get the sampler, right? This is how long ago this was. A sampler for this album. And the sampler has Players Anthem on it, like the beginning of it. And so Big Boy hears it. Big Boy calls me and says, man, is this song done? I would like to get on it, but I don't want to rap to the beat. I want to just rap to the drums, right? Separately, I get a phone call from Andre. Hey, man, is this song done? I would love to rap on it, but I don't want to rap on the drums. I just want to rap on the beat, like on the sample. Now, because they're both on Jive, we don't have to clear it. Because OutKast as a group is signed to Jive. So I get the vocals from Big Boy. I get the vocals from Andre. I let them both know that they're both going to be on the record, so there's no problem with that. Andre's like, cool, but I'm not doing no video. I'm like, okay, we'll deal with that later. And so that's why that song is the version that you hear now. But that song was originally recorded by UGK and 3-6 Mafia as an extension of the Underground Mafia album that we were supposed to do, because a lot of people don't know that either, that UGK and 3-6 Mafia were a group, Underground Mafia, and that's where Sippin' on Scissor and Like a Pimp comes from anyway, the first session of that.
See, I didn't know that. Like, Scissor was always such a dope track to me, because it felt like a screw song that wouldn't slow down, right? Like, take that Marvin Gaye sample and everybody's rapping like it's in regular time, but it absolutely felt like a screw track.
Well, yeah, no, it's supposed to be like kind of like a musical acid dream kind of a thing, right? Like, very spare and very kind of like you kind of envision yourself kind of like just swaying back and forth in your chair kind of a thing, like your head swimming a little bit maybe. You know, not full on hallucinogenic, but you got a good buzz right now, right?
Right.
And you know, it's a conscious effort to make a song as easily palatable as possible under any condition. Right. So if you're sober, it's jamming. But even if you f up, you can still get into it.
And like I mentioned earlier, I talk about, like, you know, what your life is now and looking back at it from 20 years. One thing that's interesting to see, especially with 3-6 Mafia, I've been making this argument for a while that they might have the most influence on what rap has been for the last 10 years, just sonically. Like, just about everything out of Atlanta from like 2005 on felt to me like a mid-tempo 3-6 record. Like they somehow changed the game without us even really fully recognizing as it happened that it was going on.
there's a certain type of drum patterning that if you incorporate it, and it's not always identical, but it falls into a certain pattern, that if you get anywhere close to that, it's emulation of 3-6 Mafia. There's a certain recklessness that I think today embodies what 3-6 Mafia used to be, because I don't think people realize how absolutely counterculture 3-6 Mafia was.
Right.
Like, they were not the norm. You know, just the whole point of them calling themselves 3-6 and having that, like, pseudo devil worshiper connotation to them, right, was extremely counterculture, but still being as hood as anybody could possibly be at the same time, right? So, as, you know, devil worshiper stuff, you know, in the hood, that's, you know, for lack of a better term, white boy stuff.
Yeah, that's the heavy metal influence.
Right? But that was not what they were doing, right? Their thing was more of, I'm satanic, so I'll drop one of y'all. I have no problem putting it work on y'all, kind of a thing, right? But musically, sonically, and even vocally, the stutter step flow, right, of them, and particularly Project Pat, I feel like, you know, a lot of people have marks of that and traits of that. You know, this whole double time, yeah. They were really the first people to really do that, so where their shows were really all about the energy that they could create.
I tell you this, did you think 20 years ago that you would still be rapping?
No, I didn't, because in 1992, you didn't even know if rap would still be around for 20 years. My whole thing was to do an album, see what happened, give it a year, and if it don't take off, go to college and, you know, do what everybody else is, you know, get a wife, start a family, and work in labor like everybody else. 2 days before the record deal came, because I graduated we graduated like on May 4th, May 5th, something like that. I can't really remember right now. But we graduated early May. And I was like, I'm going to give this a year. We signed a record deal with Job on like May 1st, a year after I graduated.
So you say there's like 2 days before that year came up, everything started going in the way you wanted.
Yeah, and we ended up, you know, signing with Job Records. I mean, it was a whole thing where it was a Friday morning. I was in the record store. The guy that first put us out on the record store, I was in his record store, and the phone rang, and it was Select Records. And Select Records offered us like $15,000. And we were like, no. And then after that, it was the record that Mix-A-Lot used to be. I can't remember the name of that one. They offered like $20. People just kept calling all weekend, offering money and money. And then Sunday, the phone didn't ring. We got very, very nervous. We're not even thinking that it's Sunday, it's the weekend, nobody's at work. And we're like, yo, we might have overplayed our hand. We might have, you know, messed up. We might have thrown a lot of money away. And then Monday morning, the first people to call with Job Records, and we were like, let's go.
And now we fast forward to now, you are at once rapping and you are a grandfather. And at least from what I can tell on Instagram, you seem to really enjoy this grandfather thing.
I do. I really do. I go all in. I'm literally right now a minute away from where my grandson is and probably 7 minutes away from where my granddaughter is. You know what I'm saying? Two of the kids, my other grandkids are a little further out in the city, but I can get to, you know, at least two of my grandkids at any given time. So whenever one of them gets sick or something comes up with them, you know, I'm not doing nothing during the day primarily. So I'll jump up and I'll go grab them and do all that stuff. But I enjoy it, man. I enjoy the interaction. I enjoy imprinting on them what I want them to know about this world, and even more specifically about me. Right. Like, you know, because I didn't really know who my grandfather was until after my grandfather really was too old to talk to me about who he was. My grandfather was a medic in World War II.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I can only imagine what he'd seen in his life. My grandfather was, you know, he came home, was a raging alcoholic. He used to beat my grandmother, drink really bad. And then one night my grandmother beat the shit out of him with a pot and he never drank again. And so there's a lot of things that, and my grandfather, you know, was a very, very quiet man, very still man. And so he never really talked much at all when we would come down and go and visit him. My grandmother, I had a great relationship with, but, you know, I just want to be the grandfather to my grandkids that I know my grandfather could have been to me, but just didn't have a chance to. Like I said, I wasn't there. I didn't live in Louisiana, so we didn't have a chance to build that connection. And I don't want any of my grandkids to wish they had had a better connection with me.
Are they old enough to get who you are to the rest of us?
The oldest is beyond aware. So the firstborn grandchild has seen it all and done it all. He's a little bit kind of over it at this point because, I mean, by the age of 7, this child had met Justin Bieber, Beyonce, Jay-Z. Drake had come to 2 birthday parties. Ariana Grande. I mean, you name it. This kid had met them all. Right? So she's kind of over it at this point.
I'd love
like, she knows I make music, but she's not. It's not a big deal that I make music anymore. She comes on stage. She throws stuff at me while I'm rapping, dances in the back. And now she kind of yawns, and she's like, when does so-and-so rap? I'm like, I don't know when they rap. I don't know when I rap. Well, nobody wants to see you pop up.
Kids, man, they give it to you real, huh?
Yeah, and I let her make it. She's the only one I let make it.
Now, what was it like for you, like, being a father while trying to get the rap game going?
It was different because you're not really – my earliest years, I wanted to keep my family as separate from this as possible. So there was a certain level of detachment that I wanted to have for them. But then at the same time, you find yourself away from the people that you care about the most. So you start finding different places and pockets where it makes sense. We had an incident very early where we were in Killeen, Texas, and Pimp's oldest boy – was at the show with us, and he was only maybe about 4, maybe 5 years old at the time. And their fight broke out, and they pepper sprayed the club. And so Pimp's mom and Pimp's son get, you know, they don't get sprayed, but obviously once that starts spraying, everybody's going to get some, regardless of whether you want. It's directed at you or not. And so that was the scenario of like, okay, we can't do this anymore, ever, right? Like, this is absolutely not the environment for these kids to be around. And, you know, there's certain things that I wish, you know, you look back and you're like, well, I need to make the money to take care of the family. And then you miss certain moments and you're like, man, I can't get that back. And you can always get money back, but you can't get moments back. And so you start realizing that, you know, rapping on Christmas isn't worth it anymore because they pay you extra. And it used to be the thing, like, well, man, I got to take this show. They're paying, you know, they're paying time and a half for this. But then you realize you can't get Christmases back, right? And then when the grandkids start coming around, we literally put up a block on that whole little 3-week period where there is no work around the holidays. You know what I'm saying? And now that they're older, you know, they're older, we can go out and maybe do a weekend between Thanksgiving and Christmas. But you really want to be there in those moments because, you know, we're hiding a lot of presents and, you know, organizing the family get together and stuff like that. And I used to come home on Christmas Day and say, hey, y'all, what's up? And go in the room and pass out because I'd be so tired, you know?
How,
I'm like, you know, I don't want to be that kind of host. I don't want to be that person in the family. You know, I want to be active in this stuff.
And I imagine also grandkids help with the relationship with their parents, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's funny, you get to, you know, my wife always, like lately we've been looking at a bunch of old pictures. And my wife will be like, she'll look at my son at a certain age and be like, see, he looks just like his son right here. I told them, we look at him at another age. See, he looks like Taylor right here. Oh, he looks like Brooklyn right here. You know, he looks like all these different kids. And so seeing their nature, their actions and their kids, right? And like, to me, the funny dynamic isn't just with them. Like, I see a lot of the oldest in I see a lot of my wife in the oldest. To the point where she comes at my wife the way my wife comes at other people. And my wife kind of just, it's like, it kind of like throws her off in a minute, in the moment. And not necessarily that she lets her make it, but it's very awkward to see my wife have to deal with herself sometimes. I'd be like, see, that if I told you that, you would go off on me.
We talked about this earlier, man. You made it to, like, you know, we talk about the trilogy and all that, but you made it really to full-on grown-ass man status at this point.
I remember meeting Big Daddy Kane right before Summer Jam, and Big Daddy Kane had his son with him, and his son was a big Pimp C fan. And Pimp was trying to explain, like, do you know who your dad is? And you know that the only reason there's a Pimp C is because of your dad. You understand that he opened the door for so many people, and you know, it didn't take any of a moment to think about himself. He really wanted this kid to know, because sometimes the kids can be detached from that stuff, right? Because they only know mom and dad, and they don't really, you know, understand the relation between the new generation and the old generation. So it was, that's kind of what it was always about, right? Like, it's always about the kids, and especially with Pimp. You know, he only wanted them to be the best they could be, and, you know, stay positive and stay focused and stay inspired. Because, you know, kids would come up to us all the time and be like, they wanted to rap. And I would be like, man, you don't want to get in the game. It's rough, and it's a lot going on, and it's not what everybody thinks, and it's not all fun and games. And people would be like, you can't tell people that, you know. That's their dream. You gotta let them have their dream. And I was like, man, but you know, and a lot of them ain't gonna make it. You think, yeah, Bumby, but they told us we wasn't gonna make it either.
I will hit you on one last thing before we get out of here. What was more exciting for you, meeting Obama or meeting Poppy?
You know, that's a very, very thin line right there for different reasons. They're both cultural icons in their own right and respect. I had a feeling that my wife had already put it in the air that she was going to meet Obama, and I never really thought in any time or form or fashion that I would have met Poppy. And that, to me, will always be a lasting memory.
Dude, you was a kid at Christmas walking in there to meet Poppy. Like, I felt like I saved Christmas. I was like, yo, I got Buddy here to meet Poppy, and everybody looks happy.
It's a big deal for me, man. That was a big deal for me because he's such a genuine spirit. You know what I'm saying? Like, the lights, everything's going to be a little dimmer when we lose Poppy, because we don't have a lot of people now that are super comfortable with being themselves and just enjoying life and being free in the moment. You know, people are always concerned about what people are saying and what people are thinking. We should all be able to wake up one day and live life to the fullest like Poppy, like for real.
He really is living that way. And I remember when I saw the picture of you with Obama, you may remember I sent you a text. I was like, look at you with your tuxedo that you own. I feel like that's a real crossover point in life when you go buy your old tuxedo.
My manager always owned one, and I didn't understand it for years, and because I never really went to a lot of social affairs that required that. And then we started getting invited to everything, and I was like, man, life would be so much easier if I just bought one. Because constantly going back and forth to Men's Warehouse ain't working for me.
Right.
But, yeah, you know you've grown when you got bow ties and cufflinks. You've grown.
Like, do you enjoy that fancy stuff more than you thought you would?
Oh, yeah. Like, my wife would tell you, if it was up to me, I'd be overdressed for every affair. Like, literally. Like, I feel masculine in a suit. Not that I don't feel masculine when I'm not wearing a suit, but you're undeniably a man, right, in a suit and tie. That's just me. Like, you're fully grown. You're accepting your stock in life. And this is how you want to be presented to the world, looking your best at all times. I got no problem with it. If I put on a blazer for no reason, my wife didn't stop me half the time. So many of the men in my family work labor, so I only ever saw them in uniform. And little things like that, you know, show me that I'm representing my last name in a real way.
It has got to feel great, right? Like, just to kind of look around the moments that you have to kind of inhale and exhale and look at it and be like, yo, man, this is where we are now. Like, and it's not just the you know, like generations of people. Like, this is where we are now.
Oh, the Obama picture is my wallpaper on my phone. So every time I open my phone, every time I look at my phone and see what time it is, I see that. And it reminds me of how far I've come. It's undeniable what I've been able to achieve in this life. You know what I'm saying? I got a great family to show for it. My right hand is the strongest right hand you can have. I got the love and admiration of the people around me. If I didn't want to pay for food in Houston, I know exactly where to go. I can eat free for the rest of my life. That's making it. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, man, we try to get to where you are, man. That is Bun B. The new tape's out with Static Selector. That's out now, right?
Yeah, that's out on every platform. So you can go pay for it on Google and iTunes, or you can just download it.
Hey, man, I thank you so much for joining us here, man. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Nah, man, thank you for having me. I don't know how you get better beats than most MCs for your intros, man, but keep it up.
Dude, I'm telling you, I keep trying to get Pete up with you, man. All the music people, man, so hard to get them to follow through.
But he's going to always give you the best heat first.
Yep.
That's the problem. You get first choice. You get first dibs.
You just got to pay more than I pay. That's the one thing. It ain't the hookup. I was like, how much you need for this beat? Boom. All right. We got you. Because somebody got to pay for beats these days.
That's true. Money talk.
Hey, man, I appreciate you. You take it easy, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time Podcast. Check us out at Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. Be sure to check out the Media Com show this week. She chatted with the Lebatard Show shipping container, and PFF Steve joined her to discuss the article that's tearing the football analytics community apart. It's coverage versus pass rush. Subscribe to The Right Time and the Media Comms Podcast and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.